Hello, and welcome to Power Pros Podcast, Episode 22, Legacy of Darkness. I am one of your co-hosts, the Hoff, Chris Hoffman, and with me is my mad scientist friend, Chris Slate.
Hello!
And we are back once again to talk about Nintendo. Our big topic this week is going to be spooky games that you might want to play as you prepare for Halloween. But before we get to that, we're going to kick it off with the news. And we actually got a really cool news update out of Nintendo just recently that's all about Super Mario Maker. There is a update coming next week on November 4th, and it is pretty exciting.
Yeah, I am. And this made my morning. I'm super excited. I mean, there's a long kind of wish list of things that I'd love to see them add to Super Mario Maker, and the five things they're going to be introducing on the 4th doesn't cover all those bases, but it's got some pretty significant stuff in there.
Yeah. And it starts with mid-level checkpoints.
Yeah, that's a real game changer. That's probably the biggest part of this update because, you know, one of the biggest problems I think we've got right now is that, you know, most of the levels that user-created levels that people play, they're playing them in the course of trying to unlock, you know, more Mystery Mushroom costumes. They're playing either in most cases either the easy or the medium difficulty versions of 100 Mario mode. 100 Mario Challenge, I mean. And when you're doing that, when you're going through that grind, which I've done quite a bit, you don't want to get stumped on any one level too long. So, you know, if you play a really especially difficult level, and it's difficult because it's poorly designed, there's kind of no saving that. But if you come across a great level that's really challenging, but just takes a lot of effort and maybe a few lives to beat, a lot of times people might just skip those and miss out on some good stuff. But now you can put a mid-level checkpoint in there, still offer the kind of the challenge and the tricky jumps or whatever, but give people incentive to keep playing through that level and see it through to the end.
Yeah, I mean, what you said is one way to look at it, but you know, from a creator's perspective, and I think this all kind of ties together, is that it lets you make a longer, more challenging, potentially more interesting level, and you don't have to worry about, I don't want to put this extra challenging bit here near the end because if people die, they have to go all the way back to the beginning and, you know, then they might just give up. And that's no fun. And, of course, it's up to, you know, us as creators and all the other users as creators to, you know, make good use of the mid-level checkpoints. But I think it opens up a lot of potential. And, you know, I have played levels that I've really enjoyed. It's like, oh, man, you know, this chunk at the end here just, is really difficult. And I hate having to go through all this early stuff. It's just kind of tedious. There's easy ways to slip up. And, you know, if there was a mid-level checkpoint there, I think I would have had a lot more fun with it. And, as long as people use them in good ways, this should be fantastic.
Yeah, when you think about it, mid-level checkpoints is really something that probably should have been with the game to start with.
So yeah, I suppose.
I'm happy that that it's in that this first batch of DLC. They've only confirmed this first batch, but I'm presuming this is opening the door for more stuff down the line.
Yeah, it certainly could be. So then on top of that, there is the inclusion of a status-dependent power-ups, which is something that I always thought was kind of weird because, I'm used to in the original Super Mario Brothers, you hit a block, you get a mushroom. And, then if you're Super Mario and you come across a block layer, you might get a Firefly out of that. But if you're small, you would get a just, regular Super Mushroom. And that's how it's, usually been. But that's not the way it was in Mario Maker. Yes, you could be small Mario and you could be like, oh, here's a Firefly. Here's a, raccoon suit. But now they are fixing that. You're able to combine the power-ups. You can combine a mushroom with a fire flower and then put that in a block. And that way, whether you're small or big, it gives you the proper power-up.
Yeah, as a creator, this wasn't something that was top of my list. It wasn't something that really bugged me, but it was a notable difference from how Mario games have always worked. I mean, it was rare that you'd come across a fire flower, that was a fire flower no matter what size you were.
Right.
In traditional Mario games. So I'm really glad to see this. They didn't, from what I've seen, they haven't specified that this works, with other power-ups in addition to the fire flower, but I presume it does, with the raccoon tail or the cape.
Yeah, I mean, they said that that was an example of how it works, so presumably it'll be the same way with the other stuff. I'd be kind of surprised if it wasn't.
Yeah.
But I'm happy for that inclusion because it did kind of throw me off my game at the beginning there. There's times where, I want to give, people a power-up, just like here. Just you need to be able to absorb, one hit, but, I also want it to be like, oh, well, if you got here big, then, it should give you something cool. So I don't want it to just be a mushroom because that's kind of useless to people. So yeah, I really like this idea.
Yeah. It's another no-brainer that probably should have been there from the start, if only because that's just how Mario games have always worked.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I expected, is that, you know, if you put a fire flower in a block, it would just come out as a regular mushroom if you were still small Mario. That's kind of what I figured the default would be, but they didn't do it that way. It does seem a little complicated having to combine two items and then place them in a block. I guess I'll see how it works before I complain about that.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of makes sense. It might be a little bit more natural if you just placed one item in the box and then placed another item in the box as well. But I do like how with a lot of these, I don't think they've added any kind of new spaces to the tool set. Even the checkpoints you get just by shaking a sign.
That's true.
I guess it's elegant in that way that they haven't, just piled on more things on a surface level.
Mm-hmm. So what else we got in this update?
Well, let's see. We've got the, you can now shake a muncher. You know, those little black piranha plants.
And, oh, yeah.
It was pretty well known, I think, kind of secret that if you were to shake the muncher, as it exists in the game today, it's a quick way to get the flies or the gnats to appear if you want to hit them and go straight to the...
Yeah, so then you can play that mini game.
Right, the gnat attack mini game. But now if you shake the muncher, an extra long time, you'll be able to go to a more advanced, expert version of that gnat mini game.
Oh, geez. The original one was pretty tough to begin with.
I know, it barely... I've beaten it twice out of probably at least a couple dozen tries.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and...
I remember it was hard for you to even beat it the first time.
It was very hard. And then I came back later on because my son on his save wanted to get the...
I see.
Wanted to get the costume that it unlocks, the Builder Mario costume. And so I did it for him, and I had beginner's luck. I went straight through it on the first try. But that first time I beat it, it took me forever. So I shudder to think what this is going to be like. But I wonder if, like I said, the first Gnat Attack minigame, had a hidden costume you could only get by completing that game. I wonder if it's going to be the same for the new version.
It could be. Kind of hope not. But it could be.
I love those costumes, though, and I just love like collecting them and adding them to that screen of all those classic characters. So,
yeah, getting that costume and beating that challenge was certainly a source of pride for me.
Yeah, well, you did it first. I kind of didn't even know if... of course I knew it was possible, but you're the first person I knew of that actually did it, and that kind of gave me the encouragement to see it through.
So on top of that, though, we got some new online stuff in Course World. There are going to be two new categories, event courses and official makers.
Yeah, and they're somewhat similar in a way. The official makers are, in the initial video that Nintendo released that spotlights all this stuff, they only mentioned that these courses would include, or that this would include courses made by Nintendo.
Mm-hmm.
But if you read the PR statement, it goes on to say that these are, quote, specially selected courses, including some created by people at Nintendo. So
right.
I wonder who else they might include in there. Maybe this is another way to spotlight, top users who are creating great levels, or maybe
I think
more...
it might be just, other developers, things like that. Maybe they'll dig up, some old former Nintendo Power employees and have them create levels or something like that.
If only. But
probably not that.
That brings it pretty close to the other new category then, the other new Course World category, event courses, which they describe as worldwide courses that will feature levels designed by partner creators. And they're going to be adding new courses to this on an ongoing basis.
Mm-hmm.
And we've already reported on two courses without knowing that this was going to exist in previous episodes, because there's the Famitsu, the Japanese video game magazine Famitsu has their mascot Neki the Fox.
Mm-hmm.
is going to be a costume that you can get from a mystery mushroom. But the way you're going to get it, according to an article that was in the latest issue of Famitsu, is you're going to have to beat their course that's designed by their editors.
Right.
And presumably this will work the same way for that other special costume that we heard about, the one from the Japanese television show. Was it called Game Center?
Oh, yeah. Well, the essentially, yes. Game Center CX.
Right. And it's the host of that, which I haven't watched the show. I know you remember his name.
Mr. Areno.
Yeah, Mr. Areno has his own costume in there. Mm-hmm. Supposedly, they'll have a level as well that you have to beat.
Well, and then there was the Mario-kun one. And I remember when they announced that, just a week or so ago.
That's right, yeah.
They were saying, oh, and my level's going to come out on November 6th, I think he said. And we're like, oh, well, how is that going to tie into the costume? But apparently, that's all kind of coming together now. So his level will come out, you'll beat the level, you'll get the Mario-kun costume, and that's going to be how it works.
That's right. I forgot about that one. And that'll just be a couple days after the update goes live. So we've got some new costumes.
Yeah, they stick to the original schedule. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they're also going to feature, as far as this partner creators, the only Western partner creator they've discussed so far is Facebook.
Yep.
Facebook, you know, it was in the news a little while back. They had that hackathon, which was just a day at Facebook, which is just down the street from me, coincidentally, where, you know, they all kind of try to make the best Mario Maker level. And the winning level, which was called Ship Love, will be made available through the event courses, you know, the new event courses wing of Course World.
Yeah, and I imagine that you know, come up with plenty of other excuses to have cool new courses as well. So yeah, this should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, you know, the unfortunate thing is, and everything they've done here is a huge positive, especially the midway checkpoints. But I still would like to see, in addition to having kind of more levels from partners and top creators at Nintendo, and that's a great way to discover, you know, what's probably going to be above average content. But it's still, you know, hard just looking at the millions and millions of user-generated levels. And at this point, it's been announced there's way over 3 million, I think. It's still hard sorting that stuff and getting to the good stuff there. So I feel like they still need to do another update at some point that kind of, you know, improves the discoverability of the really good content.
Yeah, it would be nice to have some additional categories for just the standard user-creator levels because, yeah, it can be pretty tough to find stuff sometimes still.
Yeah, and slopes. I'd still really love to see slopes.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, the fact that they're doing this one update, you know, opens the door for a lot more stuff in the future. And, you know, there's, you know, huge potential there. So, you know, like you said, this is all just good. All
yeah.
good news.
And it's totally free. All this stuff is totally free.
Mm-hmm. Pretty cool. And, yeah, it's coming pretty soon. Only about a week away as we are discussing this.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. Mm-hmm. I mean, Mario Maker is going to continue to be the game I'm probably spending the most time with through the holidays.
Yeah, I've kind of, you know, not been using it as much recently. A bunch of other new games, of course, have come out. You know, Yoshi and Chibi-Robo and, you know, stuff on plenty of other systems as well. But this is, you know, really going to make me want to get back on the Mario Maker wagon for sure.
Yeah, it really, we said this last week, but it really is a golden time right now. In the year for Nintendo games. I'm jumping back and forth between a lot of stuff, but I always find time to come back every few days and really get reabsorbed into Mario Maker.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of Mario, they also announced a bunch of details on Mario Tennis Ultra Smash recently.
It's about time, isn't it? I feel like they've been very quiet on that title.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's very low-key. You know, they didn't say a whole lot about it when it was shown back at E3. You know, there are details out now, and, you know, I can kind of see why they kept kind of quiet. It's not the most exciting game that they've got on the release schedule. It's, you know, not the most exciting Mario Tennis game. It's just kind of what you'd expect.
Yeah, it's like, at this point, this should come in a white box with plain black letters stamped on it that says Mario Tennis. I mean, it is what it is. It's the same meal they've fed you many times before. You know, if you like the taste of it, you know, you'll come back for thirds or fourths or eighths at this point. Personally, I mean, I'm going to get it because the gameplay is always solid, you know, in these games and the core of what it is fun, but I'm kind of not excited about it. I mean, I feel like all the stuff they're adding, the big Mega Mushroom mode and that kind of stuff is just going to be too, I don't know, gimmicky for lack of a better word. And I feel like I'm just going to spend most of the time playing, you know, just basic normal tennis, which is probably the mode when they announced all the stuff in the game that I was the most relieved to see is in there because I was afraid that the Mega Mushroom was just going to overwhelm, you know, the traditional Mario Tennis gameplay.
Yeah, there was a lot of Mega Mushroom stuff going on when I played the game at E3. And I guess what I was playing was a Mega Battle mode where there are these, you know, Mega Mushrooms just, you know, popping up all over the place to make your guy ginormous and you give him these, you know, super powerful swings. So that's one mode. Then they have Classic Tennis mode, as you alluded to. And then they have a Knockout Challenge mode, which is a one-player mode where you battle, you know, CPU opponents. But those are, you know, really the only modes that they talked about outside of online multiplayer, which, you know, is also for Classic mode and Mega Battle mode. So it seems like it's just not super robust as far as features go.
No, and the disappointing thing when I see a game like this, and I don't mean to be too critical of it. Obviously, I haven't even played the game yet. And like I said, the Mario Tennis games, at worst, are always still a pretty fun, arcadey good time.
Sure.
Especially if you've got friends over. And hey, online multiplayer for this isn't anything to overlook. But I just feel like Nintendo is such a creative company. And at times, they're so brilliant, and they can be very daring in the types of games and twists they put into their games. I just feel like it just seems lazy. It just seems like they didn't put any thought into this. I mean, Mega Mushroom Mode, that's the best you can come up with to justify yet another entry in this series. I feel like, Mario Kart 8, I mean, there's been obviously eight Mario Karts at this point. Mario Kart 8 at least said, okay, well, now you're going to be able to drive upside down. That was something. But this is just very much more of the same. Like they needed a certain number of games to be in development. This was easy enough. I don't know.
Well, it seems like every time a new Mario Tennis game comes out, especially on console, and not just Mario Tennis, but other Mario sports games as well, everyone's like, boy, I sure hope it has that great, robust RPG mode that the handheld Mario sports games used to have. And then it doesn't, and everyone's disappointed.
Yeah,
and Nintendo doesn't ever seem to care, so it's really strange in that way.
And that's at the heart of why these games aren't more appealing to me, is that I feel like they really are made with this idea that this whole family is going to get together on the couch, or your buddies are going to come over, and you're going to all just have a blast playing each other. And I'm sure that's what those games do excel at, but personally, and I'm sure there are lots of people like me, I don't, have the time or, the proximity of potential game playing buddies.
It's hard to get a whole bunch of people together some of the times.
Yeah, so
a lot of the times.
So if you're going to sit down and play it single player, it's really got to deliver, in that area too. And that's why you need a meatier mode, like an RPG mode, something where maybe you at least level up, or maybe there's a little bit of a story to play through. But what it comes down to is the only thing that keeps me playing these games is just unlocking new characters and maybe new rackets or something, if that's in this title. And ultimately, the starting crew is the ones you really care about in a Mario sports game. By the time you're unlocking Piranha Plants and Wigglers and Shy Guys, it's not that rewarding, to be honest. At least for me.
Oh, poor Petey Piranha. on the plus side, though, there is amiibo compatibility. You can use amiibo to join you if you're having trouble against the CPU and knockout challenge mode.
You essentially level them up like you do in Smash Brothers, don't you?
Yeah. You do that. Mm-hmm. The Mario amiibo, Luigi, Peach, Bowser, Yoshi, Rosalina, Wario, Toad, Donkey Kong, and the Yarn Yoshis are all going to be compatible, so that's cool. It's also cool that they've got a bunch of different controller options. You can play with the Wii U gamepad, the Pro controller, the Wii Remote, or the Wii Classic controller, and that stuff's all good. But without a really strong single-player mode, I don't feel like this game is going to deliver anywhere near what it could be.
Yeah, I agree. And it is nice to see the amiibo inclusion, though, which, in most games you'd think is a foregone conclusion at this point. But, it's obviously not supported in Triforce Heroes. And Eiji Inuma, the guy who kind of oversees the Zelda series, was quoted in an interview recently as saying they just ran out of time and they had to choose whether they wanted to focus on, core gameplay or amiibo stuff. So I guess it's not a given that you're going to get that. So I'm happy to see it when it does show up.
Mm-hmm. Well, hey, you just mentioned Triforce Heroes, and that is a game that just finally came out, a few days ago. We were able to play the demo not too long ago. We were able to try that out, give it a little, sample test run. But now we've got the final game. You've been playing that. I've been playing it a little as well. So let's move on to some impressions of latest releases. What do you think of The Legend of Zelda Triforce Heroes?
Well, I really, really like it. The only unfortunate thing is, again, I think this is kind of more of a grown man problem, is that you've got work, you've got responsibilities, I've got kids. It's not as easy to, for example, you and I to get together and then add a third person as well for regular local play, which is, I feel like this game would, that's where it really excels. But still, having said that, playing online, I've had a lot of fun with too. Now, it can be you know, like I said in my demo impressions, that can be laggy sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if it's a more perplexing level and you're really trying to figure out some tricky puzzles, it's tough to kind of get everybody on board since you know you can only communicate through the icons. But having said all that, I just think the game is very well done. I think the 3D effect it's one of the best games for that because the top-down view lends itself so well to that extra depth. And I really love the charm of it. I really have been impressed with the music and with, you know, I wasn't sure going into it. I thought, well, this game seems kind of silly, a whole thing based on a town of fashion.
It is very silly. But I didn't realize how quirky and silly it was until I, you know, took the game out of its wrapper last Friday and started playing. Like, wow, this is really goofy. But it's charming.
It is. I think the way it works because they play into the silliness. It isn't just, if they just tried to give us a more traditional or a Zelda game with a more traditional Zelda tone, but then put some of this goofball stuff on top of it, I think it would have been maybe a little bit weird in a bad way. But, you know, I love, for example, when you go into the lady's shop who makes all the costumes for you and stuff, and just the goofball music that plays in there, that la 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 la, it's just really charming. And I love the little touches, like if you stand in front of the mirror, they add more of a symphonic version of that song. And the music in general has just really blown me away, especially after I was kind of like, I was bitching a lot last week about the music in Yoshi's Woolly World and how I'm not digging a lot of the tracks. This was a really nice counter to that. I really was pleasantly surprised by just how charming the world and the music and the setting and everything and how just kind of fun it is. I don't mean to hog all the time here, but really quick, single player is still really, really fun. Even more challenging in some ways, because even though you've got one brain and you don't have to communicate with anyone other than yourself what you want to do, just moving your dolls around can be extra challenging. So I haven't found that as fulfilling as playing, you know, true multiplayer, but even single player, it's still worth playing through. I still think it's a really solid game.
Yeah, I've only really played it in the single player mode so far. I'm still waiting for some of my other friends to get their own copies, and then I'm finally gonna get together and do local multiplayer and really, really dive in deep. But for now, I'm just sticking to single player, and it is fun, but I mean, I guess mostly what I've encountered is, I just feel like I'm kind of doing the same thing three times. I guess when I get to some more challenging levels, maybe that will pass. But I think that it really is clearly designed for multiplayer, and I think it's going to increase my enjoyment quite a bit when I finally can play that mode some more.
Yeah, definitely, and it can be really challenging. I'm at some areas now where some of the puzzles that are inherent is you'll leave a guy behind, you know, because you'll form a totem, and then the guy on the bottom will throw the top two guys ahead, and you can kind of get them to where they need to go. But then you're like, how do I get this guy behind?
Yeah.
Then you start to realize you have to really think outside the box in how you use these weapons. You know, you might have to use the gust jar to blow a guy across a chasm. Then that guy, once he lands, has to turn around and grab you and bring with the boomerang and bring him, you know, along as well. So, and then you start adding other more complex puzzle elements on top of that. And it's easy to kind of forget the simple stuff. I oftentimes get really stumped and then realize, like, duh, this one guy has this item that can do this, and of course that solves everything. So it also is a game maybe that in some ways works better with three brains, you know, kind of working on these puzzles than just one.
Now I know you haven't gotten, you know, super far into the game yet, but what do you think you would rate it from what you've played so far?
That's a tricky one. I mean, I'd really be rating it as a multiplayer experience and not as a traditional Zelda experience.
Well, I mean, that's what it is, so I think that's fair.
Yeah, totally. But, you know, just to make sure no one kind of, it's that thing where if you give it a high score, it doesn't necessarily give it a certain place within the overall Zelda franchise because it's so different. I would probably give it, I mean, there's still a lot of game to play for me, but, and I've got to play a lot more multiplayer, but I'm feeling an 8, maybe. I mean, for what it is, they did a great job. What do you think?
I really haven't played enough to say. I'm going to withhold any judgment on that level for a little bit longer.
Yeah.
But, I mean, yeah, when I played some stuff at E3, as I've mentioned before, and it was shaping up really well. I have enjoyed playing lots of Four Swords Adventures in multiplayer mode. So, I have high expectations for this, and so far, so good. I'm just still, a little too early to be able to say for myself.
One thing that is really great about the game is the costumes are a great kind of carrot that keep you playing. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not a lot of exploration within the levels. I mean, you know, you can find hearts and gem and rupees, but the only real point to the levels is just clearing the puzzle in front of you so you can clear the entire level. But you're always going to rush back into town and say, well, did I get a material, you know, ingredient I needed to complete this next costume? Because once you get a costume, not only is it fun just to dress up and look, you know, silly or whatever, but then it gives you a different power that it
can be. Yeah, they got abilities.
Yeah, those abilities can change the way you play pretty significantly. And then on top of that, there's kind of the show-off factor. If you're playing with your friends or even strangers online, you want to walk around in that kind of exotic costume that maybe not a lot of people have. So they're great little rewards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. Moving on from Zelda, there's also been the recent release of Fatal Frame Maiden of Blackwater. Have you had a chance to play that one yet?
I haven't. I was actually trying to download it in time for this podcast for me to get some impressions. And it's a huge file. And I don't usually download a lot of games, but especially full retail size games. But still, my system didn't have enough room for it. So I'm currently in the process of just trying to manage my my memory and actually get the thing onto my system.
Well, I was able to make room for it. I was able to download it and start playing it. And of course, it is a free to start title, they call it. But basically, you know, it's a playable demo. Then you unlock the additional chapters by paying beyond the initial three that you can try out for free. There's a prologue, which is, you know, a very brief tutorial. Then there's two more full-fledged levels. The second of which is, you know, you're really, you know, playing on your own. It's not holding your hand anymore. You've already learned most of the techniques and you actually just get to, you know, get into it. And, you know, I would say it certainly does its job as far as feeling creepy and supernatural. I think that using the gamepad as your camera is one of the coolest and most natural innovative uses for the gamepad. It just makes sense, more than the way it's worked in any other Fatal Frame title. It's just of course your gamepad with a screen out should be a window into the supernatural world, and you can use it to photograph evil ghosts and stop them in that way, which really doesn't make sense when I say it out loud. But from a gameplay perspective, within the Fatal Frame universe, it totally works.
Now, do you just hold it up kind of at your TV screen and you kind of almost get an overlap, like what you see on your TV screen is what you see on your gamepad, except the gamepad reveals the ghosts?
Well, you see the ghosts, but as far as like their targeting points go, you have to be looking at your gamepad screen. That did take me a while, because sometimes I would pick it up and I would still be looking at my TV screen. And I'm like, okay, I know there's supposed to be something here. I'm supposed to be zapping, but where is it? I can't see it. And I had to remember, oh yeah, I got to look down here at the screen. So it does take a little bit of getting used to. But I do think it is a pretty cool use. I mean, they've been talking for a long time, oh, we got to prove the value of the gamepad. And I think this is a game that does that pretty darn well. It doesn't have, from a technical standpoint, it's lacking a little bit. It's very slow paced. And I think, it's a reasonably good looking game, but it's kind of framey. Ha ha ha. Framey. Get it? It's framey.
Oh, that's too bad.
But, because it's Fatal Frame, so it's framey. But it's also true. I noticed the frame rate would drop a little bit. But for the most part, it's so slow-paced, you don't really notice, if it's running at a low FPS. More important than that, it does deliver on some scares. It'll startle you. It'll have a ghost pop up out of nowhere or arm grab you or something like that. I don't know if it's going to convince me to, pay for the whole thing, but I think it was doing a pretty good job of delivering on its promises.
Well, it was very smart to offer those free chapters. It's unfortunate that there's no physical release, but you can understand why there's just not maybe that huge of an audience, especially on Wii U, for this type of game or this franchise in particular. But this is a game I wasn't planning to buy, so I'd kind of written it off. But knowing that I can play the first three chapters for free, I'm definitely going to try that out. So they've given themselves a chance to hook me.
Yeah. Other than the memory limitations you were talking about, there's really no reason to not give it a try. So, yeah, it's totally worth giving a spin. Hey, and speaking of ghosts and stuff, there was also a demo for Yo-Kai Watch. Definitely not as creepy, but still supernatural.
Yeah, I tried the demo out. I played through it. It basically consists of there's a cordoned off chunk of the town that you live in that you get to explore. And there's a bunch of just kind of random yokai that you find in trees and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
That you kind of have a little, almost like a little homing beacon where you can zero in on them. And then you search the area with a magnifying glass, and once you find them and uncover them, you can battle them.
Yes, you got your yokai lens.
Right. So you battle them, and then there's the three main yokai that you're instructed to go find. These are the ones that are actually kind of causing people trouble.
Yeah, you're set off on a little mission. Some person shows up. It just says a lady, but it looks like another schoolgirl or something. And she shows up and says, "Oh, there are these three yokai causing trouble. Can you please stop them?" And that's your task for this demo, is to go out and track them down and defeat them.
Yeah, and the thing about the yokai is they'll cause people to act weird. Like there's this one businessman who's basically stopped on his way to work and went to the park and is just being lazy. And it turns out he's basically being influenced by a nearby kind of lazy, yokai. And you have to kind of get rid of that spirit to make the man go back to normal.
Yeah, that's what yokai are all about. They anything that's kind of off in your day, that's what according to this game, that's the yokai. They are causing problems. Your food came out badly. Oh, it was probably a yokai or something like that.
Yep. I gotta say though, I'm interested in this series. It's a phenomenon in Japan. It's an opportunity to potentially get in on the ground floor of the next kind of Pokemon type franchise. And Pokemon itself is a little bit tough to penetrate these days. I mean, there's close to 1,000 Pokemon, you just feel like if you haven't boarded that train already, it's a little intimidating. So that's why I was taking a strong look at this one. The demo, though, it did two things. One, it told me that this is a very well-made game. Level 5 did a great job with the graphics.
Yeah, it looks really good.
In particular, the 3D effect, which I always play at full blast. Looks really good in this game.
Yeah, totally.
And it seems like, especially with the battles and everything they do kind of seemed they have done it and designed it with this eye toward how the depth of it is going to come across. So I was really impressed with that. Technically, it's a really impressive game. But the thing it also underscored with me is just this this inability I've always had to kind of connect very strongly with these types of games, the Pokemons, even the Yu-Gi-Ohs, that type of thing, where you're
That's
kind of being,
Yu-Gi-Oh is garbage.
Yeah, maybe, I don't know, but you're being conked over the head with a million kind of different terms and rules, and when you battle, it just seems like, it looks like traditional RPG style. You've got three characters in front of you that you're controlling. You can basically scroll a wheel on the bottom touch screen to scroll in more characters from your party.
You've got your three at the front that are your primary fighters, and then you have sort of a backup crew that you can cycle in depending on what special moves and abilities you need.
And then you're facing off against multiple characters in the distance, kind of like traditional Dragon Quest or Earthbound style.
But I imagine what you're getting to is that you don't really have direct control. For the most part, the battle can play out without you doing anything.
Right. I mean, the way I approach these battles, and maybe in the full game, I'm sure they'll give you more of a tutorial and maybe point out some things that I wasn't taking advantage of. But there's a special meter you can basically charge up, or a special move for each character.
Yes, the Sultimate super moves.
Right. So you tap on that icon on the touchscreen, and then you'll have to do a quick little mini game to power it up, really quickly spin your stylus around in a little wheel.
Or trace these Japanese characters.
Or touch the little dots as they appear.
Yeah, yeah.
And then your character will perform like a big attack. So basically, I did a ton of battles in this demo, but the battles for me were always just the battle starts. I kind of don't even look at the top screen. I just start doing all these little mini games on the bottom screen to perform these big attacks. And then at some point, the battle just ends. So I didn't feel particularly engaged in it. But I don't know, maybe either I'm not taking full advantage of it, which I'm sure is partly true to some degree, or there's... you know, it's just one of those things that is meant to just be very kind of new user slash kid friendly. And it kind of just plays itself to some degree, and you just don't worry about it. Just don't. Maybe I'm stressing out over the fact that I can't, you know, manipulate it to the same, you know, complete kind of degree that I would normally play a video game.
Well, I kind of have to agree with you in that, you know, it doesn't. It seemed like, you know, there's a lot of things going on that are outside your control. But I did like the fact that when you're doing these ultimate moves, that they are involving, and it's not just, you know, select from a menu, choose a move. You know, it feels like they really went back to, you know, the innovations that made the 3DS and the DS interesting. And they're like, oh yeah, you know, we've got this touchscreen here. Let's, you know, make great use of it. You know, let's spin or tap or trace. And I thought that just doing that to do those super moves, you know, made the battles more involving than it would be if it were, you know, a traditional interface. But on the other hand, like you said, you know, you're also giving up some level of you know, fine control as well. So it's a trade-off.
Yeah, and also after you've spun a few wheels and tapped a few dots and traced a few things, that gets pretty repetitive, especially since seemingly every tree in this town has multiple yokai hiding out in it. So if you really want to be, complete and take every opportunity to fight and I guess potentially capture or befriend or however that works, yokai, then it seems like there's a lot of kind of tedium and repetitiveness. But then again, maybe that's something you could say about, you know, if you're kind of a hater, maybe that's something you could say about Pokemon or RPGs in general.
Well, there certainly is a lot to do and encounter. There's a lot of these hidden yokai to find. And then there's, you know, these little meter-based mini games you can do for, you know, catching bugs or fishing. And, you know, the demo wasn't clear at all what these were used for. But, you know, I felt like all that stuff made it feel like a more, you know, robust world that had a lot going on in it.
Yeah, one thing I'll say about the game, and this is maybe my biggest criticism, and despite all of the things I'm saying here where it's not really my kind of game and I've had this little concern or that, I still think it's so well crafted and like I said, just looks so beautiful that I'm even me, somebody who's not really this game's target audience, I'm still considering picking it up. But I think my biggest complaint about the game is I just feel like, unlike Pokemon, not really any of these yokai that are, at least the ones that are in the demo that you either control or fight, are cute. You know, they're all kind of weird, sometimes ugly. There's the one that's just kind of like a little dog with a bizarre man's face on it.
Yeah, the Japanese businessman on a dog's body. It is a weird one.
One of your creatures is just literally an old lady.
Like, yes.
She's like not even like a weird animal old lady, just an old lady in regular old lady clothes. But you know, and this is where there might be a bit of a cultural divide, because from what I understand, a lot, if not all, of these yokai are based on traditional kind of characters in Japanese folklore.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I recognize the kappa, for example, which is what the you know, a character in Animal Crossing is based off of, the one that you know, drives the boat.
Cabin.
And you know, so I kind of knew that one. But so I think if you're, you know, if you're a kid, you know, it's like for here, if a lot of the characters in this game were based off of fairy tales that we're familiar with, there's already a certain kind of built-in, you know, I connect to this, I understand it, it's part of my culture, it kind of works, where it just seems that much more bizarre, you know, if you're not already, you know, ingratiated to that stuff.
Yeah, well, no, that stuff certainly bothers me. You know, I think it just kind of adds to the quirkiness. I mean, you're already talking about, you know, weird invisible ghost creatures. But, you know, to each their own. Did you fight the hidden samurai?
I didn't. I didn't even know there was a hidden samurai.
Yeah, up near the top of the map, there is a samurai yokai. And he's like, oh, I'm really difficult. If you fight me, I'm going to kick your butt. And boy, did he kick my butt. Kicked my butt all over the place. And so I went around, I leveled up a whole bunch, and then I went back and fought him again, and he still kicked my butt. And so I'm like, you know what? I'm not giving up. And I tried again. I was finally able to take him down. So
nice.
That seemed like the most challenging thing in the demo. I'm glad I was able to beat him. That was fun to do. The only problem is the difference between beating him and not beating him seemed kind of based a lot on luck. It's like, oh, is his attacks, you know, land on me or not? Sometimes it would just, you know, randomly miss. And I wish it, you know, I think that ties back to what you're saying, you know, not having full control over the battle. But, you know, then it might have been because, you know, like the, you know, option to use items it wasn't available in the demo either. So, you know, in the full game, maybe it would have been a little more satisfying. I finally claimed that victory, but it was still, quite satisfying to take down that smug samurai. I will say that much.
Without giving away how you discover and encounter the final boss of the demo, were you able to beat that final boss?
No, I think it automatically ends, after you've inflicted a certain amount of damage. I played through the demo twice. The first time I played through, I quickly went and got the three yokai I needed to defeat. Then I fought that boss, and it just sort of ended before I had claimed victory. And I'm like, well, that wasn't really satisfying. Did I do something wrong? So then I played through the second time, and this time we did lots of exploration, lots of bug catching, lots of fishing, lots of taking out extra yokai. This is when I defeated the samurai. I had a pretty buff team. I'm like, okay, I'm definitely going to win against this boss now if it's beatable. But it still ended the exact same way.
That's what I figured, but I just didn't know if there was a way I could have beaten it. But it did seem like one of those kind of forced losses that you encounter in RPGs sometimes.
Mm-hmm. My takeaway from the demo is it's definitely interesting. It definitely has a lot of potential. I could see it becoming a big hit. Am I going to personally buy it and sit down, spend a lot of time? There's just so much other stuff right now. It's hard to say.
Yeah, I think, but I think if anyone's listening to this, and we don't, I'm really just speaking primarily about my own preferences. I mean, if you're a Pokemon fan, I think it's a no-brainer that you should check this out.
I think so.
This could very well be the next big, thing in that type. My only concern, like I said, still is even if it wasn't important that you knew the Japanese folklore behind the characters or not, I just don't feel like the cast is very visually appealing. From what we've seen so far, and I wonder if they're going to have the same kind of appeal or popularity as the Pokemon characters. I don't think they can, but we'll see.
Okay, that was a good discussion. Lots of recent impressions, lots of cool news. We are going to move on to our big topic, which is spooky games, but first we will take a little musical intermission. Okay, we are back, and we are here to talk about spooky games.
Spooky.
Just in time for Halloween. I want to get to what are some great spooky games on Nintendo systems? Things you might want to play leading up to Halloween, or something to spend your Halloween night doing if you're not out there tricking or treating. But before we get on to that, what do you think makes a good spooky game, Mr. Slate?
Well, I would say atmosphere. I think it's not jump scares. It's not that stuff, although it can kind of be fun. I think it's about setting that tone and setting that mood that is at the same time potentially unsettling and a little scary, but also just kind of fascinating. I think that's the thing that, I'm not a big horror buff, but I think that's the thing that I do find appealing to that kind of stuff, is just that kind of grim fascination with kind of otherworldly things.
I think I have to agree with you. I mean, when we talk about spooky games, there are games that are, pure horror games, things that, are really can be unnerving. And then there are ones that are more lighthearted, but they've still got this spooky atmosphere going for them. And I think, that's one of the great things about Nintendo systems, that there's room for, both types of spooky titles.
Yeah, I think you could describe, to a small degree, the original Metroid and even especially Super Metroid as being a little bit spooky. I mean, I think when the games start, there's that feeling of isolation and strangeness and otherworldliness, and the music is really kind of like, sets this kind of unsettling tone. And you'd never think of that game as being a scary game, but there is something about the atmosphere that I think, it kind of, is along the exact same lines as what we're talking about, with setting this kind of, spooky tone.
Well, it's a little eerie. I don't know if I'd call it spooky, where it doesn't feel like things are going to come out. It doesn't really feel like things are going to, jump out and get you at any time. I think another key component to making a good spooky game is that there really does have to be a sense of a threat. Not always, but usually it's like, oh man, if I get caught by this thing or this thing hits me, it's all over. And you really don't want that to happen. It just kind of, it has to have that challenge component in there, I think, to really deliver on the spook factor. I think that helps a lot.
That was one of the kind of the founding core elements of survival horror, wasn't it? As Capcom's original Resident Evil kind of established that genre, was that it was about dealing with threats with limited resources.
Yeah.
Under certain constraints where you could feel the threat as a player, like you didn't want to lose your progress, mm-hmm. So they made it hard to find typewriter ribbons, which were required to save.
Yeah.
And that's a bit of a controversial kind of choice.
That's taken to the extreme.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes the ammo. I mean, you were really limited in ammo on that game. I mean, my initial thought when I played it was like, okay, I got to take out all these zombies. But then if you do that, before too long, it's like, oh, I don't have any ammo for when I really need it. But yeah, then, take it even further. You're limited on typewriter ribbons to save your game. And, then it was like your inventory slots. Like, oh, man, what do I can't even fit stuff in my inventory.
Yeah, I mean, that takes it beyond just a jump scare. It takes it beyond even a normal death in a normal video game. When it becomes, I've got so much invested in this, in my current play session, and
it's like ingrained into the play mechanics.
Yeah. Yeah. You really feel it. Even if the game wasn't kind of themed as a scary game, you'd still be kind of terrified in any game of losing the last half hour's worth of progress just because you can't find a stupid typewriter ribbon.
Yep, for sure. So what are some spooky or scary scenes in games that have really stood out to you?
Well, I'll tell you, this one might be more tilt more towards just full-blown, horror. But I think the one that maybe had the biggest impact is the opening to Resident Evil 4.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, you basically start off, there's just a tiny little bit where you go into this little cabin, and you have a little exchange there. But really quickly, you go into this village, which is arguably, mm-hmm. I would say it's probably the hardest part of at least the first half of that game. They really kind of put you to the test early, where you're kind of in this village of the damned and you don't really understand the language and they're ringing bells and crazy, scary villagers are coming out. And you just feel the sense of like you're up against overwhelming odds, like a whole town full of people are after you. They're all strange and demented. They don't seem like they're zombies, but there's something unsettling about them. And then, of course, you've got a guy with a burlap sack over his head chasing you down with a chainsaw.
Yeah, you got chainsaw guy.
And when you do finally get chainsawed, it is just nasty and startling and shocking. But then I just felt like being on the run, getting cornered, having to climb up on rooftops, and you got people climbing up after you, and not necessarily knowing, it wasn't especially clear what you were supposed to do, like how you could escape that bit. So I felt like that game really just shot you into a very scary canon, right off the bat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that is, one of the all-time, great horror games. That village is, classic set piece. It's, pretty much, perfect from a design standpoint and a scares standpoint. Yeah, after I got through there, I was like, oh man, I'm exhausted. I'm just going to put this game down and not play it for a while.
I know. Thankfully, it's relatively peaceful for a while after that village, or else I would have thought, there's no way I can keep up with this game if it's just scene after scene of this.
Changing gears a little bit to something that's a little, less traditional horror, but still spooky. It's interesting that the Legend of Zelda series kind of has a surprising amount of spooky moments. One that always stood out to me was the Shadow Temple in Ocarina of Time.
Mm-hmm. For sure. That's very spooky. And, you're not going to see someone get their, guts pulled out in a Zelda game. But we're talking about setting a mood. We're talking about atmosphere. Mm-hmm. There's also creatures and, are they called Wall Masters in the Zelda franchise, where they can take you back you know, to the start of dungeons.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so, one of the things we were talking about, you know, losing your progress and stuff that, you know, really adds to the scare factor.
Exactly. So they're creepy and they can really screw you over, which mm-hmm. makes them doubly scary. And then you talk about the re-deads, you know, those kind of zombie-like creatures that will kind of shriek and freeze you when you see them, and then they'll start slowly shambling over toward you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and you're frozen there and you can't do anything. It's like, oh, I got to mash the button. I can maybe take him out before he gets me. Yeah. Those are some of the, you know, freakiest enemies in video games. For sure.
Yeah. It's funny. I never thought about this before, but I guess, you know, it wasn't that many years apart that, you know, we introduced the ghost houses into, you know, the Mario games, which I wouldn't call, you know, spooky, but maybe in kind of a fun, like, haunted mansion at Disney World kind of vibe. But, yeah. And then also,
I mean, they're spooky, but a different fun way.
Mm-hmm. And then some of the spookier elements were added to Zelda as well. They offer some nice variety to the, you know, traditional kind of overworld, underworld, you know, water area, fire area kind of themes that you get in those games.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you were to ask me, I would say that, you know, pretty much, you know, all of Majora's Mask, you know, qualifies as spooky.
Yeah. Yeah, that is the whole thing. Very Nightmare Before Christmas kind of vibe to that game.
The whole thing at the beginning of, you know, getting, you know, transformed into a creature and, you know, you see like the whole world spinning and obviously, you know, crazy stuff is going on in Link's head is, you know, rather unsettling.
And also just the idea that that feeling of impending doom, that you can look mm-hmm. up in the sky at any point and see the instrument of your destruction. You know, horrible.
That's a creepy ass face,
grinning
too.
Face on the moon, just staring down at you. That's
like, I'm
going to
crush
you
it and kill everybody.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a great example of a spooky game, not necessarily a horror game, but it's mm-hmm. very spooky.
And then, like throughout the game, you're like, you know, finding what are basically, I mean, a lot of the times these masks are like the faces of dead people, and you're like wearing their faces.
Yeah.
And putting them on your own head.
That in addition to being spooky, I've always felt that was just kind of strange. And Link just kind of goes with it. They all think that you're the you know, the dead Goron hero, and Link doesn't correct them.
The one part I think that it was maybe the creepiest for me was the fight against Skull Kida, if you remember that part.
The name doesn't ring a bell.
Well, it's this giant-ass skeleton. He's, you know, like, you know, four stories tall or something. And at first, you're, like, chasing after him. And, you know, then after a while, he starts chasing after you. He's just this, you know, giant, creepy-looking skeleton. And you got to take him out. And it's not really that hard, but, you know, just the sight of this giant skeleton coming after you is like, oh, man.
Oh, yeah, I remember that now.
This is kind of creeping me out.
Yeah. Classic scares with the skeletons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one game I can't believe I didn't mention before now is Eternal Darkness on GameCube.
Mm.
We're talking about screwing around with the player. I mean, that whole game existed to screw around with the player. It would mess around with controls or make you think your saves had been deleted or just make you see things that weren't there. It set a very spooky tone. It had a very kind of a Lovecraftian kind of vibe to it. So it wasn't always about, you know, gore or monsters, although it had some of that as well. It was about, can you even trust what you're seeing when you play this game? Can you even trust yourself?
You know, I'll admit, I have not really played that one that much. You know, would it be worth, you know, going back and checking it out if people have missed it?
I think so. I haven't done it since it was new, so I can't really say how well it held up. But I do remember that it had a very, just from a gameplay perspective, it had a very cool mechanic in that you could target different limbs on, let's say, a skeleton or a zombie. And, you know, so if a certain creature would generally attack by kind of, you know, grabbing you, you could, you know, target its limbs first, which I haven't really seen duplicated. And as grim and gruesome as that sounds, it's kind of a fun play mechanic. And then, like I say, just experiencing the, you know, kind of the sanity effects is worth it, I think. You know, I think that game, you know, it really didn't perform that great when it came out. It wasn't a big seller. But it has a certain kind of core, you know, cult following that I, to be honest, I think sometimes tends to overrate that game. But having said that, I think it's still, you know, a really kind of clever title that, if nothing else, was filled with a lot of great ideas and creativity.
Well, for me, when talking about, you know, creepy, spooky Halloween-themed games, Really, nothing can top the Castlevania series. I mean, that's a game series that, you know, from the get-go has been, you know, all about, you know, celebrating, you know, the iconic characters of horror. I mean, you're hunting down Dracula, for Pete's sake.
Well, the first game, the bosses are all like, you know, the Mummy, Frankenstein's monster, Hunchback, you know, Medusa.
Yeah, Death, Medusa. Yeah, all, you know, iconic, you know, almost, you know, monster movie characters. You know, I think you do encounter, is there a werewolf in that game or not?
I don't think so in that game.
Definitely has mermen. Definitely has, you know, the creatures from the Black Lagoon are there jumping out at you. The later ones corrected that with the werewolf, though.
Giant vampire bats are in the first Castlevania.
Yes. Yes, they are. And Medusa heads. You were talking about, you know, scary enemies earlier. The Redeads are pretty, you know, much at the top of the list. But the Medusa heads are scary in all different way because they've just got that freaking pattern, and it seems like no matter what you do, they are designed to knock you to your doom in some way.
They just make me angry. I don't get scared. I just get mad as soon as I see him. You just said Medusa head, and already I can feel my blood pressure going up.
They are nasty little enemies.
But the thing to remember about those games, too, is back when that came out, there really weren't spooky games. I mean, we were on the NES, and it was the early days, and, you know, a lot of it was like either space fights or, you know, happy-go-lucky platforming stuff. And then this came along with a very dark kind of mood, and you're fighting, you know, monsters, and the music's kind of, you know, a little bit creepy, I guess. And so, yeah, it's not, you know, by today's standards, what you'd call a scary game, but it's definitely, as if you're talking about spooky games, that franchise is a classic.
It's definitely spooky enough by my standards. Which ones really stand out as far as, you know, the spooky factor to you?
You could probably answer this better than me because you spend a lot more time playing the DS games. But, you know, I'll always remember the first game just because, you know, the later games came with more features and, you know, more bosses. But they got away from kind of the more classic representation of, like, traditional Western spooky monsters. Like I said, in the first game, you had Frankenstein's monster, the Mummy, Dracula, stuff like that. Obviously, you got Dracula back in the later games, but, you know, the bosses became a little less, you know, traditionally, you know, classic spooky monsters.
You know, that is true to some extent, but, you know, I think, you know, one of my picks for, you know, perhaps the best, you know, spooky representation of Castlevania might be Super Castlevania IV, which in some ways, you know, certainly, you know, as far as the story goes, was like a remake of the original. And you are still encountering a lot of those, you know, familiar horror movie enemies. You're still fighting Frankenstein's monster. You've still got mummies, and you've still got, you know, Medusa to battle. So in addition to having these, you know, better looking classic horror monsters, I had some, you know, really cool spooky levels. You know, there was like a torture chamber level. There was this treasure hoard with these, you know, ghosts just constantly flying through in the background that were, you know, relatively spooky. And then I remember one of the levels towards the end, you're like trying to go up this continuously collapsing staircase. And there's this, you know, big, like, spiked saw blade coming up behind you. And, you know, trying to flee from that is definitely a highlight of the Castlevania series for me. And makes for some really good spooky moments. And then after that, I think it leads to the boss battle where you have to fight, you know, Slagra and Gaibon, I believe their names were. And after that comes Death. Those are, you know, original characters that were really creepy and, you know, just all came together really well. So that would be, you know, near the top of my list for, you know, a great Castlevania game to play to prepare for Halloween.
I've really got to go back and play that one. I haven't gone past the first level in many, many years, but I do remember... you know, the sound really improved with the Super NES, and all of a sudden they had the capability with the music to make it genuinely spooky. And I remember that the music in that game, especially at the very beginning on the title screen, was very haunting. So it definitely
creepy sound effects too.
Yeah, it definitely set a very creepy tone.
If I were going to go with one of the more modern exploration-based Castlevania games, I might go with Portrait of Ruin. Because it also, you know, brought back a lot of the classic, you know, horror motif characters as bosses towards the second half of the game. But then there's also Dawn of Sorrow, which is probably just, you know, my favorite of those Castlevania games released on Nintendo handheld. It's just an awesome game all the way around, even if it might not quite be the spookiest, but totally worth playing. Fantastic, fantastic game.
You know what would have been really awesome this Halloween? A new Castlevania game. Just makes me sad talking about all these old classic Castlevanias that seems to be a dead franchise.
Oh, I see what you did there. Dead franchise. Good one.
We'll just have it's to sad. Wait for Iga's Kickstarter game.
It's sad because it's true. But certainly Castlevania is the only, you know, classic franchise that is worth whipping out for some fun scares. It's also you know, Capcom's classic Ghosts and Goblins and its follow-ups.
Yeah, Super Ghosts and Goblins especially is the high point of the series.
Super
on the
Ghouls and Ghosts.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I always mess that up. Super Ghouls and Ghosts. you know, that obviously had much better graphics and these giant mm-hmm. bosses. And you know, those games can be very, very challenging and a little bit more than frustrating.
I think that's one of the things that, you know, makes it work as a spooky game, because that's one of those ones where it's like, oh man, anything could come from like any direction. And, you know, we got those stinking red devils that can do, you know, who knows what to yeah. you.
Every time you scroll the screen far enough to see a little bit of a red devil show up, you do kind of poop yourself a little bit.
And, you know, there's a lot of stuff coming at you. So easy to die. So easy to get your clothes knocked off and have to run around in your underpants. I think that helps a lot. I mean, you know, it's bad enough that you're having to face all this stuff constantly, you know, all these shambling zombies and things coming out of the ground and these devils and these plants shooting projectiles and, you know, these giant weird-looking monsters. But you're doing it in your underwear, which, you know, has got to be just a little bit unnerving.
And unflattering.
I don't know. I mean, Arthur's kind of buff. So your favorite in the series is Super Ghouls and Ghosts, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the Genesis game was good as well. I never played the PSP title. That's the only one I haven't tried. But yeah, I would go Super Ghouls and Ghosts.
Now, you know, there was the Game Boy Advance version in addition to the Super Nintendo version. And the GBA one actually just came out on Wii U Virtual Console and has some additional levels, I believe. Have
really?
You played that one?
No, yeah. I didn't even know that such a thing existed.
Yeah, it's actually funny. If you check the press release Nintendo put out last week, they actually seem confused and think it's the Super Nintendo version, but it is the GBA version. The Super Nintendo version's already been out there. And yeah, I think it's some sort of skill-based thing that determines which levels you get to. And since that game is really hard and I have no skill at it, getting to the new stuff, I can't remember if it was really impossibly hard. Or maybe it's like if you suck, I'll end up on the new level or something. But it's definitely a different kind of challenge and a fun one to take on.
You know what? I might have that cartridge and just never really played it because, you know, why would I subject myself to that torture again after I've beat it once? It's great to be able to say you beat a Super Ghouls and Ghosts game, but it can be quite trying to get through it that first time. But maybe I'll go back and try that cartridge out now.
And along those same lines, you know, people should remember that Gargoyle's Quest and Demon's Crest especially are out there and are excellent, excellent games. And you can, you know, turn the tables. Now you're playing as the stinking Red Devil character. And you get to beat up on other enemies.
Yeah, and we've mentioned this game in a previous podcast, and the title of it escapes me. You'll have to help me out here. But it was that WiiWare remake of a Game Boy Castlevania game.
Oh, yeah, Castlevania The Adventure Rebirth.
Yeah, that was actually one of the last Castlevanias made, and mm-hmm. therefore has some of the best, you know, graphics and everything. And it's a fun little game, so I think you can still get that through the Wii version of your Wii U or your Wii directly if you go into the Wii shop.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think I agree with you about having some of the best graphics, but it is a fine Castlevania game, and it is certainly the last one to deliver just a pure action experience.
Yeah, that's true. And maybe my memory of the graphics aren't so great, but it definitely was one of the last ones put out there, so it's pretty good, especially if you like, you know, action-y Castlevanias more than you like the exploration-based Castlevanias, which mm-hmm. I do.
Yeah, it is worthwhile. You know, of course, you know, no mention of, you know, spooky games would be complete without talking about Luigi's Mansion.
Oh, of course.
You know, clearly it's a different kind of scare. It's more of the, hey, we're just going to, you know, tap you on your shoulder once in a while to make you jump. But, you know, it's full of, you know, goofy, you know, comical type of ghosts. But, you know, it's something that still you got to play. I fired it up yesterday and started playing Dark Moon to try that out again and, you know, prepare myself for the holiday.
I still have to finish Dark Moon. I should do that for Halloween. I got really far into it.
You should.
It's one of those games I got really far into, and I was really enjoying it. But then I kind of got to a certain point where I had my fill of it for a while. But now's a good time to go back.
Yeah, now would be an excellent time. It kind of bums me out that there was never a version of Luigi's Mansion for Wii, because it seems like, you know, the pointer would have been, you know, so perfect for you know, used as your vacuum cleaner or your flashlight, just to point that and you know, hunt down ghosts or to suck them up. It seems like a bit of a missed opportunity to me.
Yeah, you'd think they would have put it out in that new Play Control series they did.
Yeah,
for
yeah, that would have made a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
Either that or a brand new version. That would have been really cool.
You know, one last title I want to make sure I mention. I talked about Resident Evil 4 on GameCube, and then they had a Wii version as well, I think. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the Resident Evil remake on GameCube.
Oh, yeah.
If you've got a GameCube or if you've got a Wii, obviously it's backwards compatible, and you haven't played that game before, that's an amazing, you know, beautiful, you know, redone version of the original classic Resident Evil.
You know, those freaking crimson zombies.
Oh, man. Yeah, and that's what you could do. And obviously, the graphics on that hold up nicely because they're all pre-rendered. So you go back and you look at what they achieved, you know, back then, just making, you know, the most beautiful backdrops they could make that didn't necessarily have to be viewed from multiple angles or be truly interactive. And it's still quite, you know, jaw-dropping.
Mm-hmm. Yep, for sure. Yeah, those are all excellent titles, totally worth playing. You know, hopefully I will get to spend, you know, a bit of my Halloween delving into some of those games.
Yeah, it's a great way to spend Halloween if you're not necessarily going to go out trick-or-treating.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I think that wraps up that topic. But before we go, I am going to deliver a dramatic reading, this time of a non-spooky game. It will be from the back of the box of the NES title, Robo Warrior. You're Zed, half man, half cyborg. The one-man battalion with a human heart and a computer's brain. Can you blast your way alone through 27 battle zones to liberate the desperate people of the planet Altiel from the evil invader Xur? Xur has seized the weather control station, its bitter cold, and the people have fled underground. He knows you've landed. No turning back. You must recover an arsenal of 12 different weapons and 6 powers hidden on Altiel. Megaton bombs, life vests, hyper missiles, super boots, crossfires, super bombs, energy capsules, life pods, power balls. Master each to save yourself from a continuing barrage of 20 deadly enemies. Wisps, Wanes, Tracers, Strinkers, Scrougs, the Globula, Golem, Virripides. Virripides? Virripides. They're mean. They're ugly, and they're after you. Flying, dive bombing, writhing, grabbing. Find the keys, or you're locked in a battle zone forever. Find the hidden chalice and be saved from eternal doom. Hit the switch. This is war.
I think the guy who wrote that was paid by the word.
I just like the fact that it starts with your half man, half cyborg. So
what's the other part?
I guess you're 25% robot.
You're 25% robot. Your mom's grandfather on his mother's side was robot.
I'm sure that's how they arrived at that.
That's it for this week. As always, you can find us at powerpros.podbean.com, and you can follow us at powerprospod on both Facebook and Twitter. You can also follow The Hoff on Twitter at Chris The Hoff, and I'm at Chris Slate. Hoff also has a really cool blog called Still Playing with Power, which you can find at christhehoff.tumblr.com. And you can email us at powerprospod@gmail.com. And if you like the podcast, we'd really appreciate it, as always, if you drop by iTunes and let us know.
Thanks for listening, everybody. For myself, Chris Slate.
See ya.
And Professor E. Gadd. We will see you next time.